And I need to, and I need to thank Lady C. You know who you are, honey. And also Reverend Stephen. Want you to know how much we really appreciate you, your first time donor. We truly appreciate you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hear about a level of Wall Street greed so gross it would gag Gordon Gekko today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown.
Only on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, immediately followed by Eco Radio KC.
Greed is good, proclaimed Gordon Gekko, lead character in a 1987 film lampooning the low ethics of the high finance barons of Wall Street. You might think that surely this Hollywood portrayal is a gross exaggeration, but check out an egregious example of gecko-level greed being pushed by today's Wall Street sharks. Big-shot financiers have been going all out to kill a sensible Labor Department rule meant to protect people's retirement accounts from the self-serving guile of financial manipulators. The rule simply requires firms that manage these accounts to put our money in investments expected to produce the best returns for us, rather than in investments that pay the highest interest fees to them. It's hardly harsh to require them to treat us common customers with basic honesty, applying what amounts to a golden rule for bankers. But, oh, howls of outrage exploded from the Wall Street baronies. Lobbyists swarmed into Washington, and scores of lawyers rushed into courts. To defend their right to be dishonest, the greed-fueled bankers resorted to more dishonesty, claiming that the fiduciary rule would hurt, quote, smaller investors. Huh? Well, they prevaricated, only by misdirecting small retirement savers into high-fee investments can we make enough profit to give, quote, affordable financial advice to workaday folks. Again, huh? These banks are wallowing in unconscionable levels of profits, but the only affordable advice they want to offer us is bad advice, funneling our retirement stash into deals that benefit them at our expense. This is Jim Hightower saying, bankers claiming that they have a legal right to profit by cheating their own customers is a level of gluttony so gross that it would even gag Gordon Gekko. For more information, go to consumerfed.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. Richard Mabian is here in the studio, and as well as our guest, Robin Martinez. And we're going to be, Robin, in addition to being KKFI's attorney, serves a lot of ways with regards to pipelines. He's been a guest on here before, and he works with regard to both the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL, and we're going to find out, and a little refresher about all those. But for, how are you doing, Richard?
Doing just fine, Mike. And Robin, I really appreciate you being here. You know, Mike was naming off the things that you do, and the one thing that I love to say about you is I consider you a friend, and you're one of the real true troopers when it comes to the environmental movement. That's what I know about you. We just don't have a whole lot of you out here.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate that. And thanks, Mike, for having me on air. You know, that's, there's a lot of ground to cover when we're talking about pipelines. And, you know, I know you guys wanted me to delve into some of those issues. But, you know, kind of take a step back and take a look at what it really is about at its core, and that is it's about energy.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, and it's about oil. It's about gas. How we get it, you know, how much of it we use, what we use it for. It's a global commodity.
You know that you hit it right there. You hit the nail on the head. When I talk to folks, Robin, I tell them that what got me started in this was David Corton's explanation of peak oil. I think if people get an understanding of what that is saying, you'll understand why we have the problems in the Middle East. You'll understand why we have all this stuff going on, and as far as those pipelines are concerned, because based on statistics, by the year 2050, the oil reserve under the ground is said to have been almost back to nothing.
Well, that's actually an interesting point of argument, because you know this whole concept of peak oil started, you know, years ago with this geologist, a guy by the name of Hubbard, who took a look at it. And what's interesting has been over the last few years, over the last decade or so, Hubbard's predictions have actually proven wrong.
Okay.
And that the available reserves of oil and gas have actually grown. And what's driven that has been better technology. Because, you know, I mean, I think in the big picture, you're right. Oil and gas, I mean, it's a finite resource. However, for our short and intermediate and even longer term needs, an expansion of, you know, or better technology when it comes to the, you know, the geophysics that they have in terms of locating and finding oil and gas reserves. And then as, you know, technologies such as fracking and horizontal, you know, what's called HDD, horizontal directional drilling,
right,
have really expanded the ability of the industry to drop the, sort of that break-even point of production to make much more, you know, oil and gas available. I mean, that's what's driven fracking in this country, is suddenly the discovery that you could take what had been previously, you know, uneconomic reserves of oil and gas locked in shale, and by applying, you know, first finding where it is and then, you know, unlocking it by, you know, by using fracking, and we can get into fracking. That's a lot of problems
there
with that.
Right, right.
Have really just ramped up the, you know, the amount of oil and gas that's available for recovery. And then you get into, you know, other sort of, you know, reserves or types of fuel as well. And, you know, this ties back to some of the pipeline issues, but, you know, you've got huge tar sands reserves.
Right.
They're up in Canada.
And see, and that's the difference. And I can understand where you're coming from and saying it's been proven to be wrong, because Hubble was speaking mostly of the Middle East thing, because they made the oil over here not really suitable for use in America. They were talking about the Alaskan pipeline oil coming out and going, being refined in Texas and being shipped over to China. So they was making that a reason for being able to create those pipelines, because your so-called scientists were saying, that oil, crude oil, that kind of oil that is not really the type of oil that we really want to be using. But you just said something that caused me to realize technology. They found ways to better approach and refine that oil.
Well, and that's largely it. I mean, one of the, you know, things that, you know, I guess is sort of, if you're looking at it from the oil industry perspective, the beauty of, you know, oil in places like Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, you know, you stick a straw in the ground and
right,
it comes.
Right.
You know, there's a big difference between that and your essentially your cost of getting that is so much lower. And consequently, it's been the advancement of the technology. And just as the price of your computer drops from year to year,
right,
you know, the price of, you know, extracting these harder to find hydrocarbons has also dropped because of the availability of advances in technology.
Yeah, we're going to delve into these pipeline issues. We're going to get into some detail, but maybe like a general overview. So we're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline are two things you're involved in one way or another. So maybe you can give a quick, you know, explanation of what each of those pipelines are about, and then your role in.
I'm happy to do that, Mike. Yeah, I mean, we set it up with a talk about energy, but, you know, ultimately, oil and gas are somewhere, and it's got to be transported to somewhere else to be refined and used. And that's, you know, that's what pipelines are all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here over the last few years, you know, the couple major projects that I've been involved in trying to oppose are, you know, were first the Keystone XL, which is a large pipeline that TransCanada Corporation wants to build to link the tar sands of Alberta up to, to transport the diluted bitumen they get from that down to refineries on the Gulf Coast. The other major project is a purely domestic pipeline that's Dakota Access, and that is designed to take crude oil that's fracked from the Bakken Shale up in the Dakotas, North Dakota mainly, to refineries in Illinois for processing. And both of those projects have, you know, been, as you know, very controversial. There's been a lot of opposition to those projects. And we can, you know, I'm happy to really kind of take a deeper dive into those. and let folks know what, you know, where they stand today and what's been involved in it.
Well, we do have Robin for the hour, so right. We are going to take full advantage of that. We're going to squeeze everything. We're going to frack every bit of knowledge we can out of Robin before this hour is over. But before we get to that, I do want to let folks know that we are in our fund drive, and this is the time when we need to come on and ask for support for community radio, for a program such as Eco Radio KC. And Richard, you've been involved with this program since day one.
Oh, man, yo. And I'm sitting here, I'm just thrilled to death to have Robin because he represents what we started this program for. I don't know of any place else in this city would you have any radio show or even TV show that would have this kind of program with someone who has been there, who has been directly involved with what's going on. Yeah, you'll get your little evening blurb about what happened here or what happened there. But this is a part. You saw when he checked me. That's the caliber of person that this guy is. And Eco Radio, we have been responsible for bringing these people to you. And that's what we learn. This is how we learn. And so I just tell you, y'all, you know how I am when I'm on these fund drive shows. Dig in them pockets. Come on. Get out in the couches. Whatever you got to do, dig up that extra money that we need to keep us on there. That's the only way we can continue to bring you what we got. I tell people in my environmental literacy work that if we don't, as a society, don't teach our future generations to love science and technology, when they grow up, they could very easily be unemployable. So it's up to us to figure out the ways to create that program. We can't put everything for our K-12 on schools. We need to be able to expose our children to what it is to love science before they get out of high school. So that way they'll have an idea of where they want to go when they go off to college or into their own work.
And so people have been listening to Eco Radio KC for many years, or some may have just discovered the program, and or maybe they listen online on the podcast that's available. We hang out after the show and make sure the podcast gets up right away so people can hear it. And if you value this kind of information, this is grassroots radio and on the ground radio. I'd ask you to consider making a contribution right now. This is how KKFI, our host station, stays on the air, by using its airwaves to raise funds, and it's an advantage we have, and we need to take full advantage of having these airwaves, and asking people to pick up that phone and make that call. 888-931-0901. Ebony and Steve are both in there, ready to take your call at 888-931-0901. You can go to online as well at kkfi.org. We need those $25 contributions, those $50 contributions, $75. If you take it up to $90 on a credit card, it's the KKFI t-shirt, a brand new t-shirt, the 30th anniversary. It's a smart-looking thing. At the $125 level, it's a pair of tickets to the 30th anniversary Folly event on June 30th. A whole bunch of great artists, Gerald Trimble, The Elders, a big roster, and it's a big celebration of our diversity. That's on June 30th at the Folly Theater. That's a pair of tickets at the $125 level. At the $150 level, you could be a guest DJ for 1 hour on any of our music programs. But the main way we thank you is with continued community radio, with service, with serving the community like we do here on Eco Radio KC. We strive to keep on top of the environmental scene, primarily in this area.
That's right.
We go national sometimes, or even international. But we try to focus in here, and even just focusing in our listening area, we can't keep up with the environmental issues going on.
That's right. Now that number is 888-931-0901. 888-931-0901. You know, they got that farm tour coming up here pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that got started just like Eco Radio. It was something that they wanted to do to show people, to showcase what they've been doing out there in the field. And now it's turned into just an annual, a major event. It's almost like the American Royal is growing so much every year. So, I mean, again, a lot of that comes through here. You hear about it here. We have our websites you can go to find out what's going on. I was checking out the name for the fun drive this time, Spring in the Summer. I think that's pretty slick. In fact, Mike has a shirt on that has that written across his chest. It looks good. It almost making me want to go get a shirt. So those shirts, remember, are $90 plus. So anything you do in that category, you're able to get one of those shirts, and they look pretty good. And this is our 30th year. We got to keep that in mind. That's 888-931-0901.
888-931-0901. All right. Well, let's maybe discuss where these pipelines a little further.
Yeah.
Well, which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with Keystone first and then come back to the one that I think is the most tragic. But let's start with
Okay. Keystone. Well, you know, Keystone is actually part of a larger pipeline system. Right. A lot of people don't know it, but, you know, there is what's called the base Keystone or Keystone 1 that's already operational.
Okay.
It pumps tar sands crude oil from Alberta all the way down to the Gulf Coast already.
Give us an explanation of tar sand crude oil. What makes that that?
Okay. That's probably a very – I think that's a good question to start with. You know, when everybody thinks of oil, you know, you typically think of drilling a well and, you know, up comes a gusher of, you know, of sweet Texas tea, you know, oil that, you know, flows straight to the finer, you know. Yeah, exactly, you know. Clampets, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the tar sands are a little bit different because what it really is, it's not oil. It's, you know, it's a hydrocarbon, it's bitumen that is locked up underground in this sort of mixture of clay and sand. And that's why, it's very sludgy.
Mm.
And it's a very thick, kind of heavy crude. And it's what's known as a heavy crude.
I've heard people describe it as the consistency of like peanut butter.
Yeah, that's probably about right. You know, if you can imagine, you know, peanut butter that would taste really nasty with a lot of, you know, grit and, you know, to it. But there are a couple of ways that they wind up extracting the crude oil from the, you know, from the tar sands. And, you know, one way is they strip mine it. And this, you know, these large reservoirs of the tar sands are largely found, you know, at least on the North American continent, up in, you know, Alberta, Canada. And that area. There's a town up there called Fort McMurray and another town called Fort McKay. And that's kind of the epicenter of the tar sands region. And strip mining is the first way that they get it. And what they do is that's an area of northern boreal forests. It's, you know, if you could sort of think of the boreal forests as sort of North America's version of the Amazon rainforest. And so first they have to go in, they have to clear the forest out, and then they strip mine it. And you know, of course, it creates a pretty big, you know, pretty big hole in the ground. And they take this, you know, this tar sands, clay, sand mixture, and then they have to separate the bitumen out from it. And since it is so thick and sludgy, the way they do that is they heat it up. And so they actually have to build other pipelines into the region with natural gas to fire up their boilers, so to speak.
So all of this is going at the tar sand pit?
Yes, yeah, and their processing facilities around there.
Okay.
You know, there have been billions of dollars, you know, invested in that region, both, you know, in terms of people buying up leases. Various Chinese companies have bought up large leases. Koch brothers are very, you know, large owners of the leases, and then there are a lot of Canadian players. Interestingly enough, a lot of the major U.S. oil companies have actually, over the last couple of years, sold their interests and have exited from the tar sands region. I think they're finding better pickings elsewhere. But, you know, the stuff has to be heated up. Once it's heated up and separated from, you know, the sand and clay, it then has to be diluted. And so they typically dilute it with other lighter hydrocarbons. Typically, they'll use, you know, the various what are called the BTEX chemical compounds that are, you know, benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylene. You know, it's pretty toxic stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they have to essentially heat it up to make it, you know, to make it fluid enough that they can then push through the pipelines. There are other, you know, types of facilities that are up in that region where they engage in what they call an upgrading process. They will make a product that they call Syncrude, synthetic crude oil, out of it as well, and push that out. So there are a lot of different processes that, you know, and a lot of different types of products that they make and with different consistencies that they'll then ship out. The stuff has to be pretty heavily refined. The thing about heavy crude is that it does contain, you know, a wide variety of different sort of parts or, you know, or chemical constituents to it. What makes it heavy, and it's often referred to as heavy sour crude, is that it'll contain, let's say, higher levels of sulfur, for instance, than, you know, than a sweeter crude will. But that's just part of, you know, that's just part of the industry parlance. Now, the reason that a lot of this heavy crude then winds up getting shipped down to the Gulf Coast is that a lot of the refineries that our major oil companies have built are, you know, number one, they're located down along the Gulf Coast. But a lot of those refineries have been specifically tooled to handle the heavy crude. And, you know, for a long time, they were getting a lot of the heavy crude shipped up via tanker from Venezuela, because Venezuela has some of the largest heavy crude reserves in the world. But because of, you know, all of the political turmoil there, that's been, you know, that's been sort of shutting down or dwindling somewhat. And so they're looking to make up the slack. And, you know, for a lot of the major players, they see those, you know, those Canadian tar sand crude as being the way to do that.
See, that, I've never heard that story. I've never heard that explanation. And as you was talking, my mind was just rolling with what that means, what it is that you actually said is going on. Once they get it liquefied enough to be able to travel through the pipes, does it remain liquefied all the way to the refineries?
Oh yeah, pretty much so. Okay. You know, because I mean, obviously, you know, there are points. I mean, it has to be. Otherwise, they couldn't continue to push it through.
That's why I was wondering: did they have a regenerating along the way where they would be able to make it liquefied again?
A lot of the stuff, a lot of it is heated and it's highly pressurized, and that's actually an interesting sort of side story. Because when I was working on, you know, on the challenge to Keystone XL, you know, one of the things I did was I was working with groups of farmers and ranchers up in the Upper Great Plains, up in South Dakota mainly, and one of the things I learned that was actually kind of interesting. And this is just sort of an odd side story about how these pipelines affect farmland. Because the crude oil coming through it is heated. And what that does is it actually dries up and drives the moisture out of the ground where the pipeline is buried in that immediate thing, which then in turn affects crop yields. And it affects, you know, the ability of the farm families to have, you know, the various types of crops and grasses and forage that they have all along the pipeline route. The other odd thing, too, is that a lot of burrowing critters happen to, you know, like the fact that it's warm in the Upper Great Plains during the winter. And so they get a lot of, you know, get a lot of creatures burrowing down there to pick up some of that extra heat from the pipeline during the winter.
I was wondering if you have to... In order to liquefy it, you have to remove something from it. You're separating something, right?
Yeah.
So does that leave waste?
Oh, yes.
I see?
And that is one of the, I think, biggest emerging issues, particularly up in, you know, up at the source in the tar sands region. You're left with tailings. Just like, you know, just like when you mine for ore and, you know, you extract the ore and you're left with all kinds of tailings. The same thing here.
So how are they, what are they doing with it?
Oh, they dump it in holding ponds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like,
and then,
like, what was that, an ash pond? What do you call it?
Yeah.
Ash, like, pits or whatever.
Fly ash.
Yeah.
It's dumped in holding ponds, and, you know, I guess they keep their fingers crossed that it won't leak.
Yeah.
The problem that they're starting to have and have had actually for quite a long time in Alberta and the tar sands region is that a lot of the toxics from those tailings have been leaching into the groundwater. They've been leaching into the rivers, and some of the stories that you're hearing out of that region are that a lot of the indigenous peoples that have lived there can no longer drink the water from the region.
Wow.
In fact, there are entire communities up there that now they've been advised don't take regular showers. Don't drink the water. If they get any water, that has to be trucked in now to them because it's been poisoned. They're not supposed to. It's affected the wildlife. It's affected the fish that are in the rivers.
And see, we're not getting that story. We're getting the pipes who leak in the ground and can get into your water, and that's pretty much being said. The main concern is that you're putting these pipes in the ground, and you never know what may happen that will cause one of them to leak. But there's other things now that are coming out, what you just talked about, that are environmental hazards. Also, I think those pits, I'm sitting up here visualizing these pools of toxic waste just sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Take a look. There are photos that you can find online.
It's pretty disturbing. It's pretty upsetting.
I mean, and I've seen some really compelling, kind of before and after pictures, mm-hmm. Showing what these boreal forests of Alberta in Canada looked like before tar sands mining, and you look at it afterwards, and I mean, it looks like the land of Mordor.
Okay. Yeah,
it's pretty grim. But you mentioned that how do you get tar sands? There's another way of extracting it as well, besides the pit mining, the strip mining that some companies are starting to use. And there's the technique is, and it's kind of interesting. It's called in situ steam extraction. And what they basically do is they'll get, very, hot steam under high pressure, and inject it down into the ground to essentially loosen up or soften up the bitumen, which they then extract. So once again, it's incredibly energy intensive because you have to pipe in natural gas to basically generate enough heat and energy to create the steam to wind up recovering the what's called the dilbit, diluted bitumen, from the ground. And it's any way you stack it up. What I think bothers me, besides all of all of the pollution that comes with it, is that dollar for dollar, it's an incredibly carbon intensive way to wind up getting energy.
Right. It seems like whatever the opposite of sustainable would be, right? The antithesis of it's diminishing returns, essentially. It's expending energy to get energy.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why, the extraction is really expensive, too.
Mm.
And, honestly, I think that's been one of the things that's, one of the reasons why a lot of the major oil companies have kind of exited mm-hmm. from, from the Alberta tar sands region has been that the cost, if oil was over $100 a barrel, they could make a profit. But I've seen some numbers that have said that, that have kind of revealed that your break-even cost for the strip mining is about just a little over $100 a barrel. And with oil now at in the mid 50s, pushing 60, maybe getting a little higher from there, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And then the in situ steam extraction also costs a lot of money. I've seen some numbers, from some oil industry experts that say it's about $80 a barrel to extract it using that. So, any way you slice it, it doesn't make sense economically. Unless, of course, oil prices go a heck of a lot higher than they are now.
So real quickly, can you give us a brief history of the legal point of view, what's been going on, starting with the fact that this was an international thing and Obama had to get involved and up to where we are today with this?
Yeah, and so we'll kind of isolate the discussion to Keystone, on that.
Yes, yes,
because that's a different issue than we've got with Dakota Access, for instance.
Right.
With the Keystone XL, that project had been underway for quite some time. And, TransCanada Corporation, because that pipeline crosses an international boundary, the border between the U.S. and Canada, under U.S. law, they had to go and get a presidential permit. And that permit had to be supported by an environmental impact statement. And there was a huge amount of time, energy, and effort that went into trying to create, you know, an environmental impact statement. And just to show you just sort of the crazy machinations that went behind it, when the project first arose and they decided which particular federal agency to have, you know, to prepare the environmental impact statement, you know, you'd think that somebody like the EPA would be the great choice for that because they know what they're doing. They've got the scientists. No, they gave it to the State Department. Then it turned out that a lot of the contractors that the State Department wound up hiring to do this study also happened to be contractors or linked to various industry groups and also linked to TransCanada, the Pipeline Corporation.
Wow.
And there was a lot of, you know, kind of lobbying that was going on where, you know, Obama administration officials had, you know, had spouses or things like that that were on the payroll of the company. And so what happened was all of those conflicts of interest wound up getting uncovered, and pretty much the State Department was directed to do a do-over.
Wow. You know?
And that took, you know, that process took, you know, took a fairly, you know, fairly lengthy time. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, Congress got involved. You had a Republican Congress, of course, that was very kind of oil industry friendly. And they actually passed some legislation that would have essentially forced the presidential permit and taken away President Obama's discretion in terms of granting it. Now, he vetoed that. He vetoed it, I think, not necessarily because he was convinced one way or another about the pipeline. He just didn't want Congress impinging on what he saw as the presidential authority. And so, you know, okay, we could see that that sort of, you know, we could see that that sort of made sense. So, you know, it took a number of years, but they finally, you know, finally came out with the final, you know, environmental impact statement. There were some supplements to it made. It was a fairly lengthy document. I mean, I've got it archived, you know, at, you know, on my, you know, on my computer, and you can actually, you still might be able to find it online on the State Department's website. But I mean, it goes, it's thousands of pages long, and you know, it covers, you know, it covers everything from, you know, an executive, it has an executive summary at the front end that gives a lot of just the core details about what they'd planned for the project. And then it delves into a lot of other details, such as it covers things like pipeline safety, risk analysis. They, I mean, they study everything from, you know, from the geology to the watersheds to they cover, you know, they even cover paleontology, which I thought was kind of interesting because the pipeline actually, or their route, cuts through areas that are very rich in, you know, in paleontological resources. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of dinosaur bones, you know, that are in the regions it gets through. And, you know, you've got a lot of sociological impacts as well. One of the big issues that kind of that came up that were actually pushed by some of the Native American tribes in the region were the construction process is not terribly friendly towards the tribes. The pipelines, you know, when it takes a lot of workers and they set up what are called man camps. And historically, when you've had large aggregations of these pipeline workers, they bring with them everything from drug trafficking to sex trafficking. And the hammer or the consequences of that tend to fall the heaviest on Native American populations that are, you know, that are in the region. And, you know, so that's a huge concern. And so things like that have to be addressed. And, you know, the list goes on. I mean, of course, you know, Endangered Species Act compliance, they have to look and see what particular species might be affected. And then, you know, how does, for instance, the pipeline company, once they've, you know, once they've buried the pipe, you know, how do they deal with reclamation of the land? Because you've got farmers and ranchers who expect to be able to, you know, to engage in their agricultural activities, you know, and you know, the, if the pipeline company is going to take their property, they need to restore it to a certain standard. And so doing that is, you know, is another issue that they need to look at.
Well,
so,
you know, as you're sitting there talking throughout the whole point of your presentation, all I have been seeing is jobs. You know, you when you started this out talking about is energy. But I can sit here right now and add to it that it's also about economics, because on every one of those aspects you talked about, I think it's genius what they're doing to be able to figure out how to get into the ground and deal with the tar sand. I mean, regardless of the negativity about it, someone figured that out. You know, they had to hire people to come in to do it. When you talked about these studies, those people getting paid for those studies. So they create this monster, and then they come back and they feed the money back out to people. That whole thing is about jobs. The people are getting paid to do that. They're not up there doing that for free.
Right. Oh, no.
Well, we're going to continue our legal update on the Keystone XL pipeline, and we're also going to find out about the Dakota's Access pipeline. But we are going to take another break to remind folks that we're in our fund drive, and it is a champion challenge. And so for the next 7 minutes, your funds will be doubled. And that number to call is 888-931-0901. And Ebony Johnson has come in to join us. Hey.
I have. Hello, everyone. This is my first time being on Eco Radio. I'm usually here on the weekends. but I want to first thank Melinda Kay, who donated online. So thank her for calling in, donating to Eco Radio.
Thanks, Melinda.
Yeah, so for this champions match, as Mike said, you get to double your money. Thank you to Greg Schwartz, who is our champion, and he is giving $100 if we can match that. So for if whatever that totals up to, whatever you can give, it'll be double your money.
That's all right, gang. This is when you go to the couches. I mean, $5, you add up, we can get that $100 made. So all of you do whatever is necessary for you to do. We see we got some lines ringing out there. Some people are calling in. Fantastic. Let's match that money, gang.
Yeah.
Like you said, we got the T-shirts that are going for the $90. We got the guest DJs for $150 and more. And I won't even attempt to talk about the program at the Follies because there's so many fantastic groups that's going to be there. I don't want to miss one if I start going through it. But that's going to be that's for $125 or more. You get a pair of passes. And I see they're going to have the Stellar House Band led by Michelle Bacon and Clint Ashlock.
And that's on June 30th.
June 30th. Mm-hmm. So, again, come on and call in here now, and let's match this money and look at what it is we'll be able to do.
We've got 5 minutes left in this challenge. Greg has been kind enough to contribute $100. We don't want to leave that on the table. 888-931-0901. We need those phones to ring. You can go to go to kkfi.org as well, like Melinda did.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go that route, you can take a look at the website and see what the T-shirt looks like. It's pretty sharp. But we've got folks here to take your call at 888-931-0901. For the next 4.5 minutes, this $100 will be matched. 888-931-0901.
Well, you got to be appreciative what you're hearing here on the air. I mean, what Robin's bringing to us is world class. I mean, you see that in itself. I'm sure those of you who follow our show out there, you environmentalists, I'm sure you're being able to hear from a firsthand view exactly what we've been hearing about through the news or knew what was going on up in that part of the country. So for that, again, it's what KKFI can provide you. No other station in this town would be able to bring you that kind of environmental news. And we need that. We need that as we're sitting around the kitchen tables and talking. Old blind guy out there, that's one thing about it. He keeps up with this show because he knows about this is where he can get his environmental news. So to call that number, 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. How much time we got, Mike?
We're about 3.5 minutes. That means we're halfway through this 7-minute challenge. We've got to get those phones ringing. It's important to support community radio. It doesn't happen on its own. It happens by people mm-hmm. picking something up, doing what they need to do. What we're asking you to do is pick up the phone, make a contribution. It doesn't have to be a large amount, although we do appreciate those large amounts. It's what you can give to support community radio, especially when this match is on the table. You can double your impact by calling 888-931-0901. And it doesn't have to all come out at once. It could be the sustained giver. Mm-hmm. And it's so where you have a little bit taken out against your credit card, every month, and it adds up to something significant for us. Ask them about that. 888-931-0901. We've got one line lit. There are three more available at 888-931-0901. There are under 3 minutes left. This is the time to make that move.
You can also, as Mike mentioned earlier, go to kkfi.org/donate. That will include the Champions Match. So if you're listening and you choose not to or whatever, can't call, you can go online, and that will help us reach our Champions Match as well.
I want to add in, that number is 888-931-0901. And Ebony, I really like the fact you come in and sit down for the first time on this show. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah,
that's right. And again, there's just a little over 2 minutes left. We have one line lit. Give us a call, 888-931-0901. We've got to get those phones ringing. We've got to take full advantage of this. Greg Swartz, he puts his money down and he puts his time in. He's our treasurer. He's on our board of directors. He's in here all the time. He's working with the Equipment and Facilities Committee and News and Public Affairs. He puts his time in, and he's also putting his money. We don't want to leave that money on the table. 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. Say you wanted to be a guest DJ for 1 hour on any of our locally produced music programs. If you contribute $150, then we would make our match, and you can be a guest DJ. 888-931-0901. Let's get those 25s, those 40s, those $50 contributions as well. It's what keeps KKFI going. Again, 888-931-0901.
Thanks so much. I appreciate, even just as an individual and a part of this community, having a show where I can tune in and listen to issues about the environment that are not sponsored by a major corporation or advertiser that wants to get a particular view out and control the story from that level. But to listen to a discussion that's uncensored, except for we can't violate FCC rules. But other than that, other than that, we can have the honest and hard and whatever conversations we choose to have here and not be censored from the standpoint of, oh, we don't want to offend any of our advertisers or sponsors. You all are our advertisers and sponsors, and you've supported this station for 30 years, and we appreciate that support.
888-931-0901.
888-931-0901. And one thing that I like about it is the people who are on this show actually work in the environmental movement.
That means our challenge is over. We'll find out if we made it. It looks like Steve's on the phone. But the number to call is 888-931-0901. Thanks to Melinda once again. Well, Robin, the time is moving quickly from us. So we haven't even finished with Keystone yet, so can bring us up to speed on that.
Wow, time flies.
Yeah.
Well, let me wrap up Keystone real quick.
Yeah.
And you know, just so you know what my involvement in it was.
Yes.
These, in addition to getting that the permit from the president, which Trump granted once he got elected, the Keystone has to be permitted in every state that it goes through on the state level. And I was involved and was lucky enough to have been asked to represent a group called Dakota Rural Action that was challenging the permitting for Keystone XL in South Dakota. And so we went, myself and my co-counsel up there, a gentleman by the name of Bruce Ellison, who some of your listeners may know. He was one of Leonard Peltier's lawyers for years.
Yeah.
Bruce and I represented DRA, and we had a 9-day evidentiary hearing in front of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, challenging this pipeline on everything from, from its risk analysis to their engineering to, I practically got a master's degree in welding, just from dealing with our witnesses. And, as we anticipated, the state is very much, it's very much a red state. And so the Public Utilities Commission went ahead and granted them their permit. And we've since then challenged that Most recently, we've taken it all the way up to the South Dakota Supreme Court, where just a couple of months ago we argued the case there, and we're waiting for the Supreme Court to issue its decision. So that's still in limbo. I've also worked on behalf of the Sierra Club, which was challenging it in Nebraska and was helping work with their local counsel in Nebraska brief the issue in front of the state Supreme Court there as well. So I've been, you know, kind of involved in both of those efforts. But that's a pipeline that's very much still in play. There are a lot of questions as to whether or not it's even economically viable, mainly because there are a lot of other projects that are coming on board that look like they may divert some of the potential shippers from that project. And so the jury's still out as to whether or not, you know, TransCanada will even build this thing.
Wow.
Or whether, you know, they've got the support from the financial community and from the oil producers to build it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, still up in the air. But since you wanted to shift to Dakota Access, that's a completely different ball of wax.
Okay. One question before you go then. Once this has been refined, are they still sending this oil to China?
Well, yes and no. Oil is a global commodity.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll just sell it to whoever the highest bidder is. So okay. Whether it's, you know, okay. Whether it's domestic use, whether it's foreign use, you know, it just doesn't really matter. Okay. Oil is oil, and it goes wherever, you know, wherever people are willing to pay for it is what it boils down to.
Okay. Switch us over now to the next one, the Keystone. What's the other one?
The other big one that I have worked on is Dakota Access.
Dakota Access. Tell us about that.
That's purely a domestic pipeline, and it's meant to connect oil that's being fracked from the Bakken Shale up in North Dakota and that area to refineries in Illinois.
Okay. And the process, I think you got something for us. Okay, the process for the Bakken Shale, is it any different than the other one?
Yeah, that's fracking. Okay. And just so, you know, maybe for listeners who don't know what's involved in fracking.
Right.
It's oil and gas that's locked up in, typically in shale, is what's known as a tight oil-gas play. And in order to extract it, you've got to drill down into the shale, and they typically will then, you know, use horizontal directional drilling to then drill out multiple directions. Then they'll take water, they'll lace it with a variety of proprietary chemicals and other like types of sands that are called proppants.
Okay.
And they'll inject it at very high pressures down into the well. And it takes roughly from what I understand, about 3 to 5 million gallons of fluids to frack a well. And
one well.
Yeah, one well. Okay. And what that then does is it essentially, you know, it fractures the rock. And once that rock underground is fractured, that allows the oil and gas to then flow upward. You know, there are a lot of issues that come with fracking. You know, for one it's heavy resource use when it comes to water, particularly when you're starting to look in areas, frack in areas that, you know, that have low levels of rainfall and are semi-arid, particularly, you know, you get out to Colorado and you get out up in the upper Great Plains, there, you know, water's an increasingly scarce resource. And once you use this water to frack a well, you really can't do anything with that water. It's poisoned. And you know, some companies have tried to, you know, capture some of it when it comes, you know, when it comes back up and try to reuse it. But a lot of the times it winds up getting essentially pumped down into what are called reinjection wells for disposal. In fact, here just fairly recently, there was a case, you know, in Kansas where some folks challenged a permit that had been, you know, that a company was seeking to drill, a disposal well for fracking fluids over in the Flint Hills. And, you know, it's also controversial because there's a lot of evidence that it's that process of disposing of that fracking fluid through the reinjection wells that's actually resulting in seismic activity and the earthquakes have been felt.
Yes.
That's been one of the things that's been plaguing Oklahoma in particular, where you've had a lot of fracking activity there, and Oklahoma's been the center point of a lot of earthquakes.
Right, unbelievable amount.
Yeah. One of the things that really, really scares me about Oklahoma and earthquakes in particular is there's a town in Oklahoma called Cushing, and it relates back to pipelines because it is pipeline central. If you could think of Grand Central Station terminal for pipelines, that is Cushing, Oklahoma. Almost all of, or a large percentage of North America's pipeline capacity and oil storage terminals are there in that town. And it actually, part of the town was damaged during a major quake within the last couple of years. And there's a lot of fear, and I think justifiably so, that if you have a quake that hits that town and actually does some real damage to the oil terminals and storage facilities they have, and the pipelines there, you're going to turn that, town into a Superfund site. That's, not to mention causing a major, disruption to our economy if all of a sudden you cannot ensure the delivery of oil and gas for, to refineries and then to, folks who put it in their gas tanks.
Why do you feel the American public is so reluctant to deal with that?
I just think people don't want to think about it. People are just too busy. Think about it. Everybody's trying to make a living. Everybody's, are working two or three jobs, to make ends meet.
But we all know that the quakes that are going on in southern Kansas and Oklahoma are new. This is something that we haven't had. And we have heard about the amount of damage that some of those are occurring, foundations cracking and all kind of stuff. You would think that we would be getting more interest or concern about that happening. But I just don't see it. I just don't. Yeah. I mean, it's far and in between to start this little group in Flint Hills. It's like we sit up here going, wow, where'd that come from that spoke up about putting that plan? No one else is saying anything.
That's right. One thing about these pipelines you mentioned earlier about how it's affecting farming, I know, with the standing with the Dakota Access Pipeline, particularly in Iowa, there were a lot of objections by farmers because the state is divided into these grids, and the pipeline cut it off people's property diagonally, which you as a result used up more farmland that they couldn't use, and so I thought that was an interesting thing. Another interesting thing about out of that Iowa that I heard, Richard, you talked about jobs before.
Right.
They were complaining in Ames that the itinerant workers on the pipeline that were there had depleted the food pantry in Ames, Iowa. So it's not like these are big jobs there. So a couple of interesting things I'd like your comment.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that about the food pantries, but I think when you look at at what the industry says about all the job creation, to a large degree, it's mythical. You do have a fair number of jobs that are created at the front end. Mm-hmm. Because it is a labor-intensive process to basically dig a giant trench, put the pipe in, weld the pieces together, put the dirt back up, and then try to reclaim it. I mean, there are a lot of workers involved in that process. But once it's up and running, it really doesn't take very many people. Jump back to Keystone XL, right. TransCanada was talking about creating, tens of thousands of jobs.
Yeah.
Well, I think when it boiled down to it, after it was all built, I think there were 45 permanent jobs out of the thing created.
That's what they talk about. It might take 500 to get it built, but then once it's built and running, if you got 45 people working there, you're doing good.
Yeah. But, jumping back to, this notion of Dakota Access, there were, there were a lot of actions that occurred in Iowa trying to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And in Iowa, it was largely farm families that were protesting it. I think what you wound up having, further upstream from it up in Dakotas, where you essentially had the impact or the potential impacts on the indigenous communities there. Yeah. Because the pipeline cut pretty close to, you know, just essentially a less mile away or so,
yeah.
You know, from the reservation area, right. The Standing Rock Sioux, you know, tribes reservation.
Right.
And that's, I think, what was almost a seminal event that really sparked, I think, a lot of people's consciousness about pipelines when you saw the, you know, the lengths and you saw the level of opposition that was engendered from indigenous communities. And that was something that I thought was pretty yeah. remarkable.
Yeah, that's great.
That's what piqued my interest, was also the indigenous communities, especially when you started realizing that they were being led into a debate and left after the front burner issues were gone. Once that happened, they kind of pretty much got stuck out there on their own. In other words, we don't have the free coats going that way. We don't have the water going that way. When the issue was front burner, everybody had all these resources we sending up north. But now, and that was something that some of the indigenous leaders were concerned about, is that once the front burner issue, for lack of a better word, was gone, who was going to continue this process?
Well, we do have to wrap this program up, I do want to thank the people from KC Co-op Solar for making a contribution. They really enjoyed the program with Michael Dowd, okay. And so that was really good. Also, Michael Dowd, you know, spoke at the All Souls Forum, and I haven't listened. We aired the program last week, and I haven't listened to it, but a friend of mine told me he's already listened to it a couple times. He said it's that good. Okay. So we'll have to we'll have to check that out as well. And so it looks like we made our goal, and so we want to thank everyone who contributed, and it's been wonderful. Any last thoughts in the last 2 minutes, Robin?
Stay active.
Yeah.
You know, I think Richard pointed out something that, you know, when all the Dakota Access protests unfolded, you know, you had a lot of attention
yes.
that was devoted
right.
to that area.
Yes.
But, you know, a number of friends of mine, you know, that are tribal members in that area and are, you know, have worked with tribal members, basically said, you know, after all the cameras went away, we're still there. And, you know, they.
Yes.
But, you know, the interesting thing that came from that is it really did spark, I think, more of an awakening.
Yeah.
And I think some of the most proactive and profound leadership that you're now starting to see on environmental issues is actually being led by members of the indigenous community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been something really remarkable to witness.
Yeah, mm. I agree.
I've noticed that a lot. Like I noticed that when I went to the People's Climate March in New York City a couple of years ago, the indigenous people who led the
yeah.
march.
Yeah.
And yeah, I noticed, like, yeah. you know, in Nebraska, it's a Cowboy Indian Alliance, yeah. right, that they really talked up there.
The CIA.
Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
Well, we want to thank Robin for being our guest.
Robin,
thank you, Richard. And thanks to everyone who contributed and helped make this fund drive a success during Eco Radio KC. There's still plenty more time to contribute. The number to call is 888-931-0901. 888-931-0901. Fiesta Musical is coming up in just a little bit, but you can still get your contribution in. We'd love to. We made our goal in terms of dollar amount, but they gave us a goal of 5 donors, and we've got 4 so far. So we need one more at 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. You can go online as well at kkfi.org. And we're gonna skip This Week in Water, and we'll go out with some music after this. 888-931-0901.
Hello, this is Charles Ferruza asking you to support KKFI, your community radio station where you hear radio like you've never heard it before.